Welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. This is Janice Summers from TC Camp. She's our interviewer, and welcome to Dr. Lucia Duras, today's guest in Room 42. Dr. Duras is an associate professor of rhetoric and writing studies in the English department, and she's the associate dean of the graduate school at the University of Texas, El Paso. She's a border resident with bordered identities and perspectives who works on collaborative interdisciplinary projects. She teaches and mentors students in rhetoric and technical writing projects. Her work on positive deviance, intercultural communication, and participatory methodologies foregrounds and leverages the assets of vulnerable populations to solve complex problems. She collaborates on risk communication and change facilitation initiatives with local, national, and international organizations, and her research has yielded numerous presentations, publications, and awards. She's the co-chair of the Hispanic Serving NESS Working Group at UTEP and contributes to leadership initiatives, and she represents the UTEP at Graduate Education Advisory Committee at the Texas Higher Ed Coordinating Board, and she's an advisory member and chair-elect of the Texas Center for Legal Ethics. We're lucky that today she's here to help us start answering the question, how asset-based inquiry methods can reveal unexpected solutions. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We are thrilled to have you here. Just excited. And it's always a delight and a pleasure to talk with you about any number of things.
Ginger and cardamom included.
The spices of life, like all kinds of things. But really quick, I want to ask a stupid question because I like to ask stupid questions.
Do you believe there's such a thing as a stupid question?
There isn't. I'm happy to play the class clown, though.
Okay.
Could you tell us what is positive deviance?
Ooh, we're starting with a hard one.
Oh, is that a hard one?
It's a hard one only because as Liz was, you know, reading my bio and I was thinking, you know, since the dissertation days, have I like gotten past the jargon? Have I? Can I communicate what I do in a way that makes more sense? And positive deviance would always get me, well, just the words, right? Positive deviance. People, yeah. And I will tell you, I've gotten stopped at the border and have a positive deviance story there.
Really?
Well, it throws the customs inspectors off, right?
Yeah.
Like, what do you do? It's like,
right?
Why were you? So I will deviate just for a second with that story because I went to get an osteopathic massage in Juarez across the border.
Okay. Right.
This was several years ago. And on the way back, and an osteopathic massage, I'd never had one, but it sounded like a good idea. You had to take your own sheets. And when we got back, we were covered, my friend and I were covered in oil.
In oil,
so
yeah.
Like basically Vaseline and God knows what petroleum products they
use.
But we were very shiny. And then, you know, when you go through customs, it's like when you go through the airport, everything comes up. And the person said, why were you in Dallas 10 times last year? And I was like, that's a weird question because I use my driver's license to go to Dallas, not my passport. But, and I said, well, I was doing a study at a hospital. Oh, do you live in Dallas? No, I live in El Paso. What do you do? I'm a professor. What do you teach? English. Because I thought, I'll just simplify it. I'll keep it very. Right. He's like, so why were you in a hospital doing research? And then I said, well, it was a positive deviance study on healthcare associated infections. That was a mistake. And then, he's like, but you teach English. It was, so those are the moments, right? Where it's like, it's not just about getting a job or explaining to somebody what you do and selling what you do, but sometimes it's kind of more, what for me, crossing the border is always the life or death feeling. Yes. And so, yes, positive deviance raises a lot of, wait a minute. So he kept asking and asking and asking. And yeah, sometimes I end up in the little rooms in the back with questioning because I'm honest, but what I say sounds so weird.
Well,
so
right.
Positive deviance. Why?
No. I was just saying, right.
I mean, and then
it's not a normal thing. Yeah.
Or say rhetoric. How about, like, let's
That's
just
not
rhetoric.
Normal either. People.
Everybody, I think, can identify with that one.
See, and some of these words are words when you're outside of academia, people have to go look up.
Yes.
Like, what is rhetoric? Right?
And positive deviance, because of the word deviance, it's like you're putting an oxymoron together.
Yeah.
Right? You're creating this. So positive deviance is people who deviate from the norm in a positive way, or organizations or communities that deviate from the norm in a positive way. And that is when the norm is undesirable. So people who have found, like, their typical definition is people who have found solutions to complex, seemingly intractable problems without access to special resources. So you're looking at what's working here and now without hiring an external consultant, without even looking at best practices, because best practices are internal or external. So what is working internally? What is working locally?
Right.
And sometimes, you know, you can take positive deviance into an implementation of a project for culture change. And I think that's kind of its maximum expression. But yesterday, one of our master's students defended a project that she didn't use the words positive deviance, but she was helping us find a way to design writing projects or writing programming for the graduate school. And she looked at what types of programs work locally at the undergraduate level. And she said, you know, we have a long running zero credit research course, and then a zero credit free self-paced course in developmental math. You wouldn't normally put developmental math with graduate school.
Right.
But she's looking at, with our culture, our local culture, and I don't mean ethnic, I mean just our UTEP culture, what has worked in the past. And so she did an internal assessment rather than seeing what we do, because we go to conferences, the Council of Graduate Schools, we see what are the best, or the Consortium of Graduate Communication. What are the best things going on out there that I can implement? And I have a ton of post-it notes here on my left with those ideas.
Right.
Which those are still great.
Yeah, they're great. They're great ideas.
It's not either or to me.
Right.
It's okay, these are awesome. I'm going to definitely keep them in mind. What are we already doing that's working? Or what ideas do we have internally that are bubbling up?
And I think I think that's a really good example. When you talk about the student who's defending a master's thesis, she's looking, and this can be translated into practitioners, right? I mean, you know, so often we go out and look at what are best practices, and asking outside of the company that we're trying to help support at what are the best practices, and then trying to shoehorn those into the corporate culture that we're in, instead of saying, well, what other programs are in the company that work really well? Mm-hmm. And I don't care where it is. It could be in shipping and receiving. It could be in accounting. It doesn't necessarily have to be in engineering. It could be anywhere, and look for those similarities and things that are familiar that work well. And how do you translate that? Because, you know, one thing we should be able to do as writers is be able to translate that and juxtapose it into what we're trying to do to inform and instruct others, right, in our writing.
Yes. And you're absolutely right that it can be anywhere. Because if you believe that we are a system where, you know, if the pinky finger is hurting, the rest of the body feels it, then you believe that we're all here kind of for the same purpose, especially if you're a mission-driven organization, and if everybody who is there, you know, accepts this mission and goes with it. You could have, there's a famous case, there might be a YouTube video out there of Jasper, the janitor, the cleaning staff at a hospital. There's a YouTube video showing how he takes his gown off when he goes into high risk, high infection rooms. That in the end, like he peels it off, and in the end it ends up in his glove inside out. And that minimizes waste.
Right.
and minimizes vectors for infection in the way he does it. So then it's like the solution came from cleaning stuff,
right?
Not from the CEO, not from the doctors, yeah.
Not from the scientists.
Not from the scientists, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. It's not education related. It can be just believing though that people have ideas.
Yes.
And that's a key step in positive deviance, is you really have to believe that that people have something to contribute, that there is a possibility of doing things from the ground up that are going to be just as good as what the traditional experts would do, or better, or whatever. You know, it's about seeing people kind of eye to eye.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I find the most attractive, is like we're all on equal playing fields, right? We all contribute and we all have value. There's an inclusion that I feel with positive deviance.
Well, you are including people who are normally excluded, and positive deviance as an implementation, because I'll talk about it in different ways, right? As an inquiry strategy, you could use it to design a study and simply ask a positive deviance question, right?
Just now, how would you instead do that?
So for example, in the Journal of JBTC, Journal of Business and Technical Communication, right. My recent article on design thinking and positive deviance talks about designing your studies with a positive deviance question and asking. So we were in the context of federal probation and recidivism. So instead of attempting to go into the root causes of recidivism, which hopefully somebody is doing, and we're very happy about that, we're asking the people that are managing, that are most at risk of recidivating once they've been released, but are managing to stay out of trouble, what do they do? What do their everyday lives look like?
Right.
So we're looking at the things that are working when they shouldn't be working. These people that should be in prison but aren't, they should be going back to prison but aren't going back to prison. What are they doing differently?
Right.
So the emphasis is also in the actions. What are they doing? How are they saying things? So one of the things that we found is that they have a plan in their back pocket to, if they run into an acquaintance, and they call them an association that would lead them into trouble, they would say, I'm going to tell them that I'm going to go work, depending on what's going to work with that individual, right? I'm going to work on my grandmother's roof, because grandmothers respect.
Right.
There's an older gentleman who would start reading the Bible and just be like, I've turned to God, and that worked for him. But having a thing that works for you, where you're comfortable saying no, and you're not going to get hassled for it.
Right. But they have it's interesting. It's a positive strategy.
It's a positive as well. Communicative strategy.
Like they've they've developed a positive communicative strategy in advance of anything happening. So they've got something. So they don't have to scramble and think about, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to handle it?
Yes. And it may seem, some of the behaviors we found might seem kind of commonplace. Like, well, of course, one of the things is they wake up at the same time every day. They're very aligned with their routine. Mm-hmm. So I wake up at the same time every day. I wash my face. My wife makes coffee. We drink the coffee together. We talk. Even those details, right? You have somebody that you have a meaningful conversation with. Check. So as a researcher in that context, it was more about finding the strategies and then giving those strategies to probation so that they could develop a checklist or beef up their checklist with the people that they work with. That was kind of what it was about. I didn't work in the organization. I didn't go on into full implementation mode there. That was, so for me, it was more of an inquiry.
Right.
Than a culture change intervention.
Right.
That's where you could use it for that.
Right.
But if you want to implement this in your organization, get everybody involved. And this, the reason we couldn't do it like that is that it's a sensitive population, and you can't have people who have been in prison all in the same room all the time for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't, those are the people that are at, on the ground level. Mm-hmm. And so in a different organization, we would have wanted to involve everybody at the same time. Here we had to do more like conversational interviews. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's different ways to do positive deviance, but even like this master's student, just asking a different question will yield a different answer. Just make sure you're asking the question. That's the, remember right. to ask the question, the perspective taking question.
Well, it's asking a question, isn't it also framing the question? You know, before you ask it, you frame it from a different perspective, I think.
You do, you absolutely do, because with, when you're doing a positive deviance intervention or study, it has to be grounded in data too. Mm-hmm. So it's how you're looking at the data. So you're looking at the norm at the, mm-hmm. in the middle of the bell curve mm-hmm. to establish the problem, to say, this is what the problem is, to define the problem. But then you're looking at the edge that we normally don't look like, look at least
the outliers. Not
the outliers. We don't look at it for a long period of time, or we just kind of make a brief stop there. Mm-hmm. I was recently working with some quantitative researchers and I asked them, I was like, do you ever look at outliers? Is this just something, you know, weird? And they said, no, we do, but just to make sure that we're not missing anything, but we do tend to stick at in the middle of what's the norm, what is, because we want to look at patterns. And in positive deviance, you're not really looking at patterns, because when you're looking at outliers, you're looking at a very small population.
Right.
So you're really looking
at the deviance from the standard distribution. You're looking
exactly.
at
exactly. Right? So it's really hard as a researcher, depending on your training sometimes, to go in and say, because we're always patterns. I mean, even grounded theory yeah. and mm-hmm. constant comparative method. Oh, once I have enough saturation, I'm gonna move on to the next pattern. And here you might notice patterns among the outliers, like routines. We could right. categorize them as a pattern, spirituality or some kind of connection with a higher purpose. Okay, pattern. Right. But what we're interested in is that thing of, I don't know, I only meditate for 5 minutes, or my prayers have to do with gratitude. It's that key mm-hmm. thing that everybody could implement. Right. I might not be able to ever meditate in my entire life,
right.
but I could somehow find a way to incorporate gratitude.
Right, you could create a gratitude statement instead of meditating. Right.
Like, what are you thankful for? What went well today?
You can just think the word gratitude, just have that little sticker somewhere, right? I mean, so that's like really interesting, because you're drilling in, and you're not on the surface of, oh, it's a prayer or a meditation, therefore some religious conscious. You're going deeper into, mm-hmm. you know, what is it? And unpacking to find out that it all goes down to the word gratitude, for example.
And it has to be replicable.
Right.
And immediately actionable by everybody, accessible right. to everyone.
Right.
That action, so now we're going full circle to what we were originally talking about. With one of the principles of positive deviance is that it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to yes. think your way into a new way of acting, right?
So yes. Can you say that again?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very action focused. It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. And what that does is it changes our perspective from the knowledge, changes attitudes, changes practices paradigm to a different thing. Practices, change your attitudes, and change your knowledge. At first, I used to think, is this PAC, practices, change attitudes, change knowledge, a replacement for the CAP paradigm? And now I see it much more as, no, sometimes, right? Sometimes you think about our behavior. Sometimes I know that in order to get into any kind of body movement routine, I can't overthink it. I can't, like, I'm not, you, I could be convinced and not do it. Mm-hmm. So it's really about doing it. There are some things that it's a matter of doing it. And then once you do it, it's like you're telling your body and your body is agreeing and saying, oh yeah. And then your body wants it. Mm-hmm. And then you think, oh, that's really good. And now I know X, Y, Z. So I think it's a matter of saying, which one am I going to use right now? And we were talking before this call about our need to be so agile on our toes about now we're using masks, now we're not using masks, now we have this, now we have that. Yes, we have a lot of issues, lots of problems and difficult things going on in the world, but it's really like, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this?
That adaptability.
Yeah.
And being able to take that, practice, right?
Yes.
Approach as well.
Yes. And so it doesn't mean that I'm not going to have moments. I'm not like about to write a book on self-help about how, amazing my life is or how, but it does help me always, like, now my bias is that looking for that different perspective, looking at so I ask myself heuristic questions, mm-hmm. in not just in my research, but in my everyday problem solving of, is this true? Does this happen 100% of the time? Are there exceptions? What are the exceptions? So I start to do that drill down in my everyday conversations with people. And there's a lot of power in that. I have to say, right, with those of us who work with language, it's good to realize the moments where it's like, wow, there's a lot of power in how I'm asking this and what I'm getting people to see. So right. That matter of inclusion, you are being inclusive, but just because Positive Deviance has a tendency to be inclusive and asks a question, another principle is nothing about me without me, or who is not at the table that should be at the table.
Right.
Those are important questions because it's not automatically inclusive. We still have to make sure we're checking ourselves with those things.
Well, and I think that's one of the basic tenets. We always have to be checking, right? Because there's behaviors that are natural, right? They're almost primal. And unless we're always aware and asking those questions, we're going to exclude because it's kind of a primal thing and we have to overcome that and change that.
Yes.
Right? Consciously. So that's one of those things. Like I have to tell myself I need to drink 4 glasses of plain water a day. I hate doing it, but I need to tell myself repeatedly. It's not in my nature.
Yes. And so right. There might be a positive deviant way of doing that, right? Where it's not as painful, or where you remind yourself, or this has been used in diabetes, with one of the things that I remember from one of the diabetes studies is the importance of disclosure.
Yes.
One of our students at UTEP did a study here with the local population, and it was about telling people that you have diabetes, that step, and then having your family then say, hey, it's kind of tough. Are you sure you're gonna eat that? Or I don't know if I could do that. But what are the things that help people stay on track of their regimen or of their compliance with certain medical protocols?
Right. And as writers, the technical and professional writers, how would we apply that to our trying to write instructions or information that inform or educate the general public? Mm. Right?
That's good question.
How would we change how we do what we do using positive deviance?
Hmm. Yeah. How are you imagining procedures differently, or are you? I mean, that's really, I don't have the answer to that question. I think that's a good question I would love to ask people is, do they imagine themselves or do they imagine positive deviance influencing procedural or instructional write-ups?
I think it would be really interesting for practitioners to to study more about positive deviance, and because I can see where that could go, mm-hmm. right? Because they're writing for an audience. How do they perceive their audience?
Well, and they're interviewing all the time, mm-hmm. the subject matter experts and other, and the project managers and the feature writers. And like, you're asking questions all the time.
Right, yeah. Right. And I guess I do have a little bit of a sense of how that could go, in that the closest I've gotten to it is this end of life decision making project that we were working on with Guillermina Solis from nursing here, and then Laura Gonzalez and Heather Turner. We were looking at end of life decision making glossaries or manuals or those pamphlets that we get. They exist in English and they exist in Spanish, but the assumptions that they make about how people are able to make decisions, the context for people making decisions, if you consider positive deviance, I think you would have a different manual. In fact, we prototyped a bilingual glossary. Uh-huh. And we also started to consider different things like that people are thinking about, like family values, spirituality, notions of God, and how, you know, it's not just, and then of course all of the legal jargon, and so the legal was the technical, really technical aspect of it, but making it bilingual here for bilingual people could help people better understand, because if people are constantly using two languages, mm-hmm. then having something in one language and then in another separately might have some gaps that a bilingual glossary could fill. So that's one example. A glossary is not quite an instruction manual, but it does, we had a little bit of a decision tree of, you know, if yes, then this, if no, then blah, blah, blah. So I could definitely see that. I'd be interested in learning more. I'm such a curious person, you know, and I'd love to hear if people do this, let me know how it goes. Love to hear about it or read about it.
And I think, you know, the nature of the technical and professional writers is that they're very curious about a lot of things.
I think so, right? We all have that in common where it's like, yeah, where is this going to go?
So I think we've thrown down the gauntlet for someone to take up, or for you to do in your research project.
Absolutely. Yeah. We could collaborate on something. Definitely. I'm a collaborator.
You are.
So I don't understand that question, Liz, that you want me to ask. You asked.
Well, so it was back to the procedural thing. Right. One of the sort of fundamental questions that all of us ask is like, do I just ask about this procedure or do I try this thing? Mm. And that's something we do all over the place, right? People will ask a question rather than go and dig around and look for it. Our nature is to ask.
Right.
So asking better questions, that can only help all of us, really.
Absolutely. I think so. And procedurally, it could also help us use it, you know, do I try to do this? You can also ask outliers about their experiences. I'm thinking about an engineering leadership professor here who worked with somebody in physical therapy, occupational, it was something related to disabilities, but they were looking at the hacks that people make to their equipment to make it functional. So when you have a different body and a different, you know, way of functioning that is not in the norm, and you still need to find a way to do things. Yes, there are a lot of great inventions, and there are wheelchairs, and there are things that help. But sometimes the best inventions come from the users, right? And somebody who had a pencil that they would, you know, attach to God knows what, and then they would use it to poke with their mouth. I mean, those things, that's what they were looking at. And so sometimes it's about, you know, what are the users doing and who are the users, and really getting familiar with that.
Right. That's something that like all of us do. We all have extra things or little things that we do that's unique to us and how we do things. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to discover those things unless you're really asking and digging down, because you're just like, oh, do you do anything special? No, not really. Right. But there's always something. Yeah. Right.
People, positive deviants generally don't know that they are positive. They definitely don't call themselves that. That would be weird. But it's not something, you know, obvious a lot of the times. That's why the drilling down and the observation becomes so important. Observation is the key. When I was able to go to released individuals' houses, the project really came to life, because our initial interviews were in rooms, were in offices,
right,
just for safety, vulnerability, for many different reasons.
Right.
But when we were at their houses, I was able to ask questions, right? Are those yours? Do you collect them? And you can, that leads to, but looking at objects displayed, yeah. Or one of the probation officers had their team, sports team paraphernalia in their office. And, you know, when we asked him, he said, well, that's the conversation starter. And it seems like, obviously, that's why people, but not everybody has things in their office that are meant to engage. They're just kind of things that represent me that I put there. Or
their personal cues.
For this person, it was a strategy, positive deviant strategy.
Well, yeah, and all of these things, like our environments, give us glimpses into a person's psyche, right?
Absolutely.
And how they process things. I like the fact that in positive deviance, you're looking for positive things. So if you're looking at how applications work, right? So if you're writing instructions for a software application, and you actually have the ability to talk with someone who's actually using the application, and they're candid and they feel safe and comfortable being candid, they can tell you, I don't read that because that's a waste of my time.
Yes.
I go click over here. I go do this. I don't care what your instructions say. This is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Because me as a user, I've adapted, right?
Yes.
Because your tool does something I need to have done, and I will figure out a way to make it work. And I think as a technical writer writing instructions for this software, that's the person I want to talk to. Find out, how is it working for you? What are you doing? And withholding any judgment on, you know, if they're going to tell you that, you know, your writing was not effective, that's okay. Because, you know, we want to find out, how do we be more effective? Because there's probably more people like that. If you can interview a lot of people that are using the application in a positive deviant way.
Yeah. I mean, at a very simple level, it's feedback.
Yeah.
Feedback on something that actually makes a difference. And the other, a study I didn't do, but that is from Norway. They looked at the Norwegian prison system.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that the first thing is that they didn't look, the officers did not read the files before meeting the individuals. That's rare. Normally,
you get to see
who is this person.
Right.
And then the other thing is they would give them a tour of the facility upon arrival. Who does that? So, I mean, if you're writing a manual, you would put, read the file, take the person to their cell, and then, you know, those instructions would be 1, 2, 3, like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it through a positive deviance lens, it's first thing, don't read the file. Second thing, before you take the person to their cell, show them the facilities. And then we're talking about treating that person like a human being first, and then, yes, there, that doesn't mean there's no consequence and there's no, whatever they're doing time.
Right.
But you're treating them like a human being. And that means that when they leave, they will leave hopefully as a human being.
Well, and it's starting, it's how you set that relationship, right?
It sets the tone.
That relationship, it sets a tone and it changes the dynamic, right?
Yeah. And I think so go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I think that's one of the things with technical and professional writers, is that does set the tone and it does establish the beginning of the relationship.
And it's kind of, one of my students called it a front end investment, right? She's like, you do it at the beginning and then it pays off. It might take a little bit of time, but there was another PhD student here, Dolly, who she came off as introverted and quiet. And so when she told me this, it really caught me kind of off guard. She said, when every day of the semester, I shake every student's hand. I was like, whoa, that takes a lot of courage. That takes time, courage. She's like, it's quick though. I mean, yeah, it does, but I'm connecting with them.
Yeah.
And maybe she is not going to, maybe she does. I don't know what she's like in her classroom. Maybe she's super entertaining, but that small gesture with every student, like every day, every day I stand there and I greet them. It's not the same as, hey, everybody, good morning, welcome, how's everybody doing? Yeah. No, this is like, I see you, you're here. No. So you don't have to do it. Yeah. Maybe somebody says, you know, I'll do that the first day of class. That's good. That's a good enough, you know, whatever works for you. You don't have to shake. So whenever we elicit or articulate these practices, doesn't mean that you interpret them verbatim and have to do them. Is it replicable? I don't know. Maybe some people are uncomfortable with that idea. And maybe now it's more like, hey, knuckle bump or whatever. But maybe you just do it at the beginning, the first week, so that they know you're whatever.
And I liked what you said earlier. Maybe we didn't get a chance to quite talk about it in any depth, but I liked what you were talking about is the community. Like, you have to look at the community or the culture of the situation, right? Situational, and adapt to the situation, right? Mm-hmm. Some cultural aspects, some would be more welcoming than other situations.
That's right.
So it's not all rote and this is how it is.
No. And it has something to do with localization too. It's not just localization so that we can make this effective. It's localization so that we can make this meaningful and sustainable.
Yes, it's meaningful and sustainable. Those are great words.
Mm-hmm. It's more for that. And I can tell you, some people might wonder, I mean, is this, because a fault of positive deviance is that it is not addressing the systemic issues.
No.
It is a local, you're finding local solutions to problems. You're doing kind of this self-reflection and you're looking at assets. And I think that's good to bring up assets. In my context, it works. It's important because, for example, here we are on the border, Hispanic serving institution with 82% Hispanic, not Hispanic serving. We just became Hispanic serving and we're, you know, going off of a checklist, but this is kind of like our people, or we care. Mm-hmm. There's a culture of care approach at the university. There are a lot of systemic things that we need to be aware of.
Yes.
But one of the things we're doing is looking at what are the things, how do we handle this current divide, critical race theory, systemic oppression, not this, Black Lives, you know, the tensions, the national tensions and the global tensions. We are aware of them, but we also feel like we have to look at them, and we have been good at looking at them through our unique lens and experiences. So when we say Hispanic, throw out the blanket Hispanic term, or Latinx, or we see that in our own way. We have a different way of seeing it. And so rather than just taking what are the best practices in blah blah blah, how do we do things in a way that is meaningful and sustainable and just, you know, what does justice look like on the ground here? Not just what does the Oprah Book Club tell us, or what does, although I've read some really good stuff from there, but, you know, so we have to look at both. and negotiate.
Right, and I think, I think too, one of the things that you bring up, that you're aware of the systemic issues, but you look at the positive deviance and the assets that you have on hand to make positive changes and to create positivity now.
Here and now. Because the other thing is that some things are going to take a while.
That's going to take a while to solve, but you can solve for the here and now. Right.
So it's a matter of what do you want to do in that moment. For me, you know, sometimes I want to invest my energy in the systemic long-term impact, whatever that's going to be. Other times I want to look at making an impact now so that we can get through something.
Right.
Or because I honestly, sometimes I feel cynical or hopeless about the system. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what are the workarounds? It's not, you know, it depends on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something, even though I have that bias, it's not something I also have this systems lens, hopefully, and if not, nudge me, because it's really important to keep that in mind.
And to absolutely
do both.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, this has been such a fun conversation. I can't believe our time is already up.
I know.
I have so enjoyed talking with you, and I hope to have you back again.
Absolutely. It's been great. Thank you so much.